For those of you who receive our email prior to this program, you know that the title of it was going to be The Middle East Crisis, Time to End the Jihadist Bodyguard of Lies. But we have to address something first before we get into the show, which will take us from Washington to London to New York to Tel Aviv to Toronto. We have had a series of the most ungracious demonstrations in this country over the past 2 days. And one comment struck me by the president of the Coalition of Arab Canadian Professionals, who said that this is not an Arab issue. It's not a Muslim issue. It's a Canadian issue because we're talking about Canadian values. And he's right. But I question whether these people and their fellow travelers understand what Canadian values are. Our values lie buried with the tens of thousands under crosses on fields where poppies grow. Our values lie buried with the 24,000 men we lost at the Battle of the Somme and the 15,000 we lost in the bloody cliffs of Dieppe to be free, not to engage in political equivalency, not to be subservient to duke or dictator, or mullahs for that matter, or terrorists for that matter, and not to abandon sister democracies in a game of numbers of who killed more. Because if we want to get into those numbers, the Allies from World War II killed 5 times as many German civilians as the German bombers killed in France and England. The current Middle East crisis has brought Canada to a fateful hour, a new rendezvous with destiny. Not because of the threat of uncontained conflict, for containment there will be. Not because of any pressure from rising oil prices, for rise they always will without any need for any pressure. Not because of some perceived humanitarian tragedy, for the true tragedy of human perception lies in ourselves. No, this is a fateful hour, because it will test our courage, conscience, and character as a people. And our response to this challenge will determine much of what we will be able to achieve at home and abroad in the years to come. George Bernard Shaw wrote that liberty demands responsibility. That's why so many dread it. During this crisis, we will see whether we have the courage to shoulder responsibility, whether we possess the conscience to embrace liberty, and most importantly, whether we have the character not to dread. A brave new prime minister of this country is trying to restore the vision of Canadian pride and purpose. He is putting the world on notice that we have the steely resolve to marshal our vigilance and re-engage in mankind's transcendent struggles for redemptive change. If we flag or falter in that vision, we will retreat to the sad spectacle of cowering in undeserved smug self-satisfaction that has been Canada's hallmark these past dozen years, a hallmark that has masked nothing less than our own self-doubt driven by our jealousy of other self-belief. And that jealousy and self-doubt have begun to rear their ugly heads once again in recent days. Though still broadly supported throughout the land, Stephen Harper's vision has come under some gratuitous attacks in the past week, particularly among those in the knee-jerk, anti-American, progressive chattering classes in both of Canada's official solitudes. This conflict did not start, as many of these commentators would have us believe, with the kidnapping of 2 Israeli soldiers by Hezbollah. It started when Israel unilaterally pulled out of Gaza and was assaulted over the successive months by 1,000 Qassam rocket attacks carried out by Hamas. Nevertheless, called the bound that someone, and that someone always seems to be Israel, has to have the courage, in quotes, to stop fighting. Well, Israel tried. It did not retaliate for a single attack. It took the body blows. But then Hamas was elected the governor of the Palestinian Authority. That was the beginning of the road we are on today. Within an hour after the attack on Kerem Shalom on the Israeli side of the Gaza border, which resulted in the deaths of 2 Israeli soldiers and the kidnapping of another, Hamas gleefully accepted responsibility for the planning and execution of it. Hamas, as the ruling entity of a political jurisdiction, had committed an act of war against another political jurisdiction, the State of Israel. Does everybody get that? Hezbollah's attacks near Kiryat Shmona in the north that resulted in 8 dead Israeli soldiers and the kidnapping of 2 others was also no mere act of a terrorist group, for Hezbollah is much more than that. Hezbollah, adding to its long, glorious list of attempted attacks in the World Trade Center, kidnappings of Terry Anderson, holding hostage Lebanese women and children, cowering behind them, is also a political party and is part of the Lebanese government holding two cabinet posts. That government has for 6 years, 6 years following Israel's unilateral withdrawal from South Lebanon, refused to comply with UN Resolution 1559 and disarm Hezbollah's military wing. And Lebanese President Lahoud and Prime Minister Zanora have gone beyond mere refusal in just this past week. Zanora was taped in an interview by Italy's respected Corriere della Sera as stating unequivocally that he does not want Hezbollah disarmed. Lahoud went even further on CNN when he flatly declared that the Lebanese army, which Lebanon has consistently refused to dispatch to the south, will fight with Hezbollah against Israel. Lebanon has declared, in fact and in law, and against the desires of most of the Lebanese people who so valiantly attempted the Cedar Revolution to be free, following the Syrian Hezbollah assassination of Rafik Hariri, that the Hezbollah military is a division of the Lebanese army. In so doing, the Lebanese government has hoisted itself on its own petard. I was ashamed this week when Canadian Louise Arbour, head of the Human Rights Commissioner for the United Nations, stated that this may be a question of personal responsibility for attacks on civilians. She doesn't know her law. It's time for her to go back to school. International law recognizes that any country attacked by a terrorist group may prosecute military reprisals against that host country of such a group as if, in International Legal Authority Robert Tucker's words, that country itself participated in those attacks. This is known as the doctrine of self-help. It has been accepted by every legal authority from Julius Stone to Derek Bowett, from Kelson to Oppenheim, as applying equally to the United Nations when that august body will not or cannot act. Due to Canada's sponsorship of the International Commission on State Sovereignty and Intervention, the ICSSI, we have yet another dimension to self-help, that being the responsibility to protect. Two successive Canadian administrations have embraced and endorsed this ICSSI doctrine, a doctrine which not only obligates a state to protect its own citizens against attack, as Israel is doing, but goes further and imposes an obligation on the family of nations to protect any population that has been the victim of aggression and violence by its own leaders within its own borders, overriding the ancient Westphalian standard of physical borders being sovereign and sacrosanct. But in the case of Lebanon, we need not even resort to these noble standards of international law. The government of Lebanon, through its president and prime minister, has made it abundantly clear that Hezbollah, both politically and militarily, is an integral part of the Lebanese ruling authority and of its army. Indeed, just this morning, the Lebanese government authorized billboards calling on all true Muslims to kill Israelis. Therefore, the actions of Hezbollah are ipso facto done in the name of the Lebanese state. And as tragic as the fate of Lebanese civilians is, are therefore acts of war against the Israeli state, committed by Lebanon as well as Hezbollah. And Israel is permitted full retaliatory response to defend itself and its people. The implication that Israel is targeting Lebanese civilians and not taking even minimum precautions to protect them, as we've seen in many columns and many commentaries, borders on the worst kind of bias, the basest kind of hypocrisy. Israel has showered Beirut with millions of leaflets before any raid. Loudspeakers announce any action 20 minutes to an hour before. On Friday, Israel invited television crews to film its preparations on the northern border, something that NBC military analyst and U.S. Medal of Honor winner Colonel Jack Jacobs called wonderfully humanitarian but militarily stupid because it put Israel's soldiers at risk by exposing their positions to Hezbollah. What army has ever attempted to be so open, transparent, and decent in the protection of civilian populations? No civilians have ever been targeted. Yes, many civilians have died, over 300. And some 40 Israelis have died. And yes, 1,000 Lebanese have been injured. And 600 Israelis have been injured. And yes, there is displacement of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. But 1.2 million Israelis abandoned northern Israel. Is Israel to be criticized because they can protect their civilians better than the Lebanese government can protect theirs? Israel's bombings of Hezbollah positions in South Lebanon and in Beirut has been as surgical as possible, Contrary to many, the pictures we see on television, even the bombing in South Beirut, has been limited to an area of approximately 20 blocks long by 10 blocks wide. President Lahoud himself, unintentionally, of course, pointed this out to CNN correspondent Nick Robertson 2 days ago. Israel, on the other hand, has even offered to participate in its rebuilding. Anyone seeing the tape will view of Beirut pretty much intact, except for the area where the Hezbollah cowards position their guns and headquarters in the human shield of civilians. Yet all these progressive commentators we keep hearing about don't question Hezbollah's strategy of hiding behind women and children, not only in South Beirut, but in the villages of South Lebanon. And curiously, all the progressives fail to mention that Hezbollah and Hamas have openly stated its policy that all Israeli civilians are fodder for their homicide bombers. Yes, it's sad that Lebanese have been killed. It is also sad that Israelis have been killed. Is it any less sad that Israelis have had to suffer over 9,000 terror attacks and thousands dead in the past 6 years, as the Lebanese are suffering bombing today? Or is Israeli blood cheaper than Lebanese blood? General Louis McKenzie pointed out recently that if numbers crunching was a standard of rules of engagement, how would the Allies have avoided condemnation in World War II, since they killed five times as many German civilians in bombing raids on German cities as Germans killed in bombing raids on France and England? Does Hezbollah give any warning when they shoot off hundreds of Katyusha rockets? Then we have the gratuitous attacks on Prime Minister Harper's bold foreign and military policies. Many commentators have said that he, quote, slavishly follows the lead of the United States. It's an insult to Mr. Harper. It demonstrates the chattering class, knee-jerk anti-Americanism of so many Canadians and Quebecers. And it exhibits an ignorance of what Canada's legacy is, a legacy that includes having twice the number of servicemen and women in uniform as a percentage of population than America did in both world wars. Mr. Harper is not following the U.S. He's leading Canada. He was the first Western leader to demand that Hamas renounce violence upon its election, the first to cut off non-humanitarian aid to Hamas, the first to demand the arrest of Saeed Mortazavi, the Iranian prosecutor who beat Montreal photojournalist Zahra Kazemi over the head with his shoe during torture sessions that led to her death. And Iran sends him as its observer to the UN Human Rights Council meeting in Geneva. That is who we are dealing with, Iran, the sponsor of Hezbollah. And when Harper declared in Kandahar that Canadians don't cut and run, he restored Canadian pride and purpose and put the world on notice that we're back on course as a nation that engages in mankind's transcendent struggles for redemptive change. No longer were we to be just salon liberals cowering in smug self-satisfaction. There have been charges that Ottawa is bungling the evacuation effort. It took Canada no longer than America to organize this effort. But it is harder because Canada has no military assets in the Mediterranean, no ships, no planes. And once again, to quote General McKenzie, this is the result of 15 years of opposition by the same progressives who attack Harper now, who opposed any purchase of any military hardware, whether it be heavy lift capacity or any naval vessels. Canada has to lease them from private enterprises. Or don't the progressives get the memo? We talk about a scale of the evacuation. Quebec media has been particularly nasty on this, saying things like, Canada's only attempting to evacuate a few thousand, and it's screwing it up. Well, it's not a few thousand. There are 40,000 Lebanese who hold Canadian passports. They don't all live in Canada. Only some 10,000 do, but over 25,000 have applied to be taken out. America, with 10 times our population, only has to take up 10,000. Don't facts matter anymore? Or are they mere fodder to be molded to suit preconceived notions? Israel's defense of itself and its people is not, in another favorite phrase of the progressives, a perpetuation of a cycle of violence. For as history has shown, every time Israel remained quiescent and accepted the body blows, Arab states and terrorist groups viewed this as a sign of weakness and attacked again and again and again. Nor is it an eye for an eye, as he says. As has been said, in the 1920s and 1930s, there was no Israel or a Hitler. Hundreds of Palestinian Jews, however, were slaughtered in Jaffa, in Hebron, in Sfat, and half a dozen other cities. All these murders were done on the instructions of the religious and political leader of Palestine's Arab Muslims, the Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who spent World War II in Berlin as a guest of and radio propagandist for Adolf Hitler, and was to be tried at Nuremberg as a war criminal before he was smuggled back to the Middle East with the aid of the French and the British. Husseini's nephew, by the way, Faisal, was one of Yasser Arafat's closest collaborators. and as a co-founder of the PLO, an active participant in that organization's continuing bloodlust for the Jews. This particular week, we've also lived through a shameful spectacle, particularly in Quebec, when media and academic types went totally berserk when Quebec Tory MP Jean-Pierre Blackburn had the temerity, and I say that in quotes, to call Israel an ally of Canada. Some French talk show hosts even refused to use the word Israélien. They badger with the word les Juifs, the Jews, instead. But they don't call the Hezbollah murderers les Musulmans, the Muslims, oh no. They are les militants, the militants. I thought that was something the Liberal Party used to call its workers. But then can you imagine the sin of it, calling a sister democracy an ally? No, the progressives in this country would much prefer that we stay enslaved to the bankruptcy of moral relativism and loyal to our true Canadian doctrine of the right of failed states to be wrong. Funny thing, though, the intelligentsia, again, particularly in Quebec, had no problem when French President Chirac boarded the French nuclear submarine Vigilant some months ago and declared his readiness to use nuclear weapons if radical Islam ever threatened the glorious French Republic. Not a peep of criticism on that. Anyone else wondering why? In 1970, Pierre Trudeau enforced martial law, abolished basic civil liberties, and put 10,000 soldiers into the streets of Montreal when the FLQ kidnapped British Trade Commissioner James Cross and Quebec Labor Minister Pierre Laporte, eventually killing the latter. When Trudeau was asked by a CBC reporter how far he would go to protect Canada from internal terror, he glared angrily into the camera and declared, "Just watch me." It is the basest form of hypocrisy that the left today upholds a double standard in condemning Stephen Harper's support for the sole functioning democracy in the Arab Muslim middle rim of this small planet. Does Israel's democracy have any less of a right to for self-defense against external terror than Canada did against internal terror? And the problem goes even deeper than that. Not to put too much of a point on polls, there are two things that bring into stark relief the disconnect of Canadians from the reality of World War IV, as former CIA Director James Woolsey calls the struggle against Islamist theocratic tyranny. Europeans, who have felt the brunt and burn of jihadist bombs from London to Beslan, voted 82% for Israel in a Sky News poll on July 17th. In Canada, a recently released Léger poll showed some 57% in favor of the Prime Minister's unequivocal support for Israel. You know, my friends, I started in politics stuffing envelopes for Robert Kennedy as a kid. And he said many times, in many places, that courage was the cardinal human virtue. We can only hope that Canadians will shed the hypocrisy they cling to as children grasping their favorite blanket and find the courage to rise to the call of virtue in this most dangerous of times against this most dangerous of enemies. If we fail, we will be condemned to Dante's admonition that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who maintain their neutrality in times of moral crisis. For as Andrew McCarthy, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, has written, Israel's war is our war, for it is the frontline state in the family of free nations. We are fortunate to have a prime minister who knows these lessons well. It is to be hoped that this land and those protesters that were in the streets that talked about Canadian values will be deserving of him. We'll be back with our first guest after this. Montreal, we're going into a news break, but I just wanted to give you a rundown of the show. We're going to start from Washington, D.C. with Bridget Gabriel, founder of the American Congress for Truth, author of Because They Hate, a Survivor of Islamic Terror Warns America. We're going then to General Louis McKenzie, who's going to be talking about the Justice of Canada's position on Israel and Ottawa's unearned bad rap on the Lebanese evacuation. From New York, Andrew McCarthy, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies on why Israel's war is our war. And we're going to be speaking with former Bloc MP Richard Marceau on media positions and bias on Israel. And all that's coming up after the news. Our first guest is not only a remarkable person, but is one of the most passionate, informed, and authentic voices that everybody needs to hear on what is going on in this crisis. What is this new last gasp axis of evil between Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, and Syria, and the damage it causes to people in Lebanon? Bridget Gabriel is a survivor, and I don't mean that pejoratively. She survived physically. She survived hate. She survived bombings. She was a former anchor for the Middle East Television Network. She's now become the founder of the American Congress for Truth. and I encourage you to go to that website, AmericanCongressForTruth.org, and the author of the upcoming Because They Hate, A Survivor of Islamic Terror Warns America. Go to Amazon.com and look for it. Bridget Gabriel, it is a pleasure and an honor to have you. Your appearance on CNN was breathtaking. How are you today?
Thank you. The honor is all mine.
Bridget, I'm sorry to have kept you for so long, but obviously you heard I had a lot to say. I know you say it a lot better and a lot more passionately and succinctly. What is the progressive left not getting about this story?
The progressive left is not...
And I use that in quotes.
That's right. They are not getting the facts. They do not know the history. They have not been paying attention to what's been happening over the last 30 years. They think this is a crisis that just started. And I thought you were brilliant in the way you introduced the first half an hour and the way you set up the situation in the Middle East. And as you know, knowing my background,
I think our listeners would like to know your background. Because your voice comes across sounding like, you know, a fine, nice American girl. But there's more to you than that.
Yes. I was born and raised in Lebanon. And at that time, in the late 60s and the early 70s, Lebanon was Paris of the Middle East, the banking capital of the Middle East. A lot of people do not realize that Lebanon was the only Christian country in the Middle East. We are a republic like the United States of America, which made us very differently than a lot of other Arabic countries surrounded us that are a one-man regime ruled by either one dictator or one royal family. Because we were the majority Christians when we got our independence from France, the Muslims were the minority. Because of the majority Christian population, we were able to build Beirut to become Paris of the Middle East. We built the best universities in Beirut. We had the best Western culture in the sea of an Islamic world. And in 1967, National Geographic magazine had on its front cover, the title was Lebanon, Eden of the Middle East. All that began to change as the Muslims became the majority in the country by the late 60s, early 70s, and the Christians...
Particularly after Black September in 1970 when Jordan threw out the PLO and I think President Frangieh took them in.
Exactly.
And let them carry arms, sorry.
And we always had our problems with the Muslims, but the problem became aggravated with the influx of the Palestinians out of Jordan when King Hussein killed them in Black September and kicked them out. As a matter of fact,
the problem was not just Muslims. The problem then became politicized with
exactly.
an agenda.
Exactly, exactly.
The PLO were not necessarily the most religious Muslims, but they had a political agenda that
exactly.
was at odds with the way Lebanon lived and worked.
Right. Exactly. Yasser Arafat in Jordan tried to throw King Hussein out of power in order to establish a base from which to fight Israel. When he failed to do that in Jordan because of King Hussein's strong leadership, Lebanon was the only country that accepted them in at that time. They came to Lebanon and they tried to create a base from which to fight Israel, and they succeeded because the Lebanese government was very much into multiculturalism. We were very open-minded, very tolerant. We opened our borders. We took them in. Because the majority of them were Muslims, they put their heads together with the Muslims in Lebanon and declared jihad on the Christians and began fighting not only the Christians, but began fighting Israel.
Well, I think it's necessary to point out that not all Muslims were Islamic jihadists. There were Muslims living very much at peace with Christians going back hundreds of years in Lebanon.
That's right.
It's the politicization of radicalization Islam that changed after 1970.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened.
What happened to you personally?
I was, in 1975, when the war began, I was 10 years old. They bombed my home with their Katyusha rockets in trying to take over the military base over my house. They missed the military base, and their Katyusha rockets landed on my home, bringing it down and burying me under the rubble.
How did you survive?
I was wounded. I ended up in the hospital for 2.5 months. And while I was in the hospital, I would ask my parents, why did they do this to us? And my parents would tell me, because we are Christians, the Muslims consider us infidels. So I knew ever since I was 10 years old that I was wanted dead simply because I was born into the Christian faith.
Bridget Gabriel will be back with you right after this short break. Our operator, Chris Smith, just reminded me about one of my favorite lines of poetry from Dylan Thomas. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Do not go gently into that good night. And certainly our guests are not going gently into the that night of stupor. Bridget Gabriel, you've told us about what Americans have forgotten about how Americans in the world have forgotten about how this crisis started. I want you to be patient because we're fighting clocks and we're fighting calls. Stay on the line with us because I want to bring in General Lewis McKenzie to discuss what Canadians don't know about what it took to evacuate the Lebanese and why support for a sister democracy is important. He's fighting the clock, and then we're going to get back to discussing what you're doing now, if that's okay with you, Bridget.
Sure.
Lou McKenzie.
Yeah, Beryl, sorry for that. It's a busy day.
I understand. Hell, you're one of our last hopes in this country. I'm happy that you're going on all kinds of places.
We're in rough shape then.
Oh, stop it. What don't Canadians get? They were babbling in the Parliament. Canada shouldn't buy ships. We shouldn't buy planes. We shouldn't have heavy lift. We shouldn't have Hercules aircraft. We don't need any more ships. All of a sudden, the Dunkirk standard that we got to evacuate overnight and come up. What don't they understand about this?
Well, I think there's an excuse for them, quite frankly, for most of them. I mean, we all know about the media. Man bites dog's pretty popular story, and in this case, they ferreted out and found people that were bitching and complaining, and you can understand the frustration. And I think I know for a fact that there were many, many more, if not the majority, that were just happy to be looked after and got out of the country and understood that, gee, there's no air conditioning and not a lot of food and we're short of water. And I mean, duh, it's a war zone. But on all networks, the BBC, CNN, they're all focusing on the whiners and the complainers, and that naturally upsets the rest of us because we're paying for it.
But I don't mean just that part. You had a wonderful line earlier this week where you said to someone, you reminded someone, you know, we have to get across something called the Atlantic Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah, well, France, Greece, Italy, they all have a coastline on the Mediterranean, and the Brits, for God's sake, have two large sovereign base areas on Cyprus, an hour away by chopper, or 5 hours by sea. So they're in the area, too. The Americans obviously have their fleet. It's pulling up off the shore now in many locations. I think if anything would be done differently the next time, I think probably the staff would not tell everyone to report to the harbor. You know, a lot of nations processed their people away from the harbor and sent them down in manageable bites on 40-passenger buses, so they're all processed by the time they arrive at the ship. Unfortunately, when you pull a couple of thousand people in front of a barbed wire fence with a single gate and you start calling out names in alphabetical order and happens to be the guy at the back of the crowd and has to fight his or her way through, you've got a real serious situation on your hand. But nevertheless, good intentions, small embassy staff, very small budget, an extremely difficult situation. I'm not sure that I would encourage people to come from South Lebanon up to the harbor, from the frying pan into the fire through South Beirut. I'd be more inclined, and I hope they did try to arrange with the Israelis for safe passage down to Haifa, for example.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the Israelis have been taking an injured Lebanese. Do you think the left in Canada is going to get it this time and understand that we need a stronger military for humanitarian purposes, just like we relied on the army in the ice storm in Montreal?
Well, we've been lobbying for an amphibious capability, which would be able to lift a couple of thousand people in a situation like this. But, you know, don't hold your breath. If it's leased, we could have it in 3 or 4 years. If it goes from blueprint the way it normally does to actually sailing the thing, then, you know, you and I will be 12 years older.
Lou, I'm going to ask you one last question. I know your schedule is tight today, but you heard Bridget Gabriel expound on Lebanon and Lebanese history as the first, the only democracy in the Arab world.
I lived there at the time, Beryl.
When do you think Canadians are going to get it that it is important to have a foreign policy that our prime minister has articulated of commonality with sister democracies around the world, that we are really facing an important enemy?
No, I quite agree. I mean, I'm speaking at a Support Israel rally here in Toronto on Wednesday, and I will tell the rally. And I hope they understand if there was a rally for the Lebanese people the following day in another part of Toronto, I'd be there.
Clearly, it's not a matter of Israel or Jewish or Muslim. It's a matter of freedom.
We're talking about protesting against the terrorist organization that, quite frankly, I think has been duped. Duped by Syria, duped by Tehran. And I wouldn't be surprised if a Russian finger is back there too, sort of waving around a little bit with their newfound confidence and loves to see this turmoil turmoil and America being drawn in and Israel being drawn into this. I mean, this is big power politics playing with the poor Lebanese people again.
Is this that sort of last gasp of the retrograde axis of Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, and Syria as they see some form of democratic openings, even enforced democratic openings in Afghanistan, Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq? Is this a fear that once the door is open to some kind of transparency, they won't be able to close it again?
No, that assigns to them a political motive, and I don't think there's a political motive here. There's an obsession, a missionary obsession, to destroy Israel and push it into the sea and kill anybody that doesn't interpret the Quran the way they do, quite frankly. I think it boils down to a missionary under.
And the question of Islamic hegemony over the West? Over any free nation?
Yeah, it's an impossible task, but they're sure in hell going to try. And while they're trying and they're killed while they're doing it, you know, they guarantee a safe passage to paradise along with members of their family. So it's a pretty hard thing to put down, but it's got to be stopped.
Final question. How do we get this through Canadians' minds, particularly much of the media?
I don't know if there is a way. God knows
people. I know. We're going to send Lou McKenzie out five times a day.
No, God knows people have tried, but there's a very... very safe, secure platform we sit on here where we look at things in black and white, and we don't really turn off, the simplistic interpretations that you see in 15-second soundbite. I heard this morning that one of the areas of Beirut was bombarded. That was a quote from CNN. There were 6 bombs in 20 minutes. Somebody should know that bombardment is 6 bombs every second. I mean, if Israel wanted to turn Lebanon into a parking lot, it could probably do it. It's being relatively selective. And I've dealt in another campaign where people have a habit of setting up their weapon systems, being hospitals and mosques, etc. So when the other side retaliated, naturally it made for good TV coverage.
Lou McKenzie, thanks for your time today. Good luck today and tomorrow. Bridget, stand by. We'll be right back with Bridget Gabriel from Washington right after this short break. Montreal, we're back, and we're talking about the bodyguard of lies in this Middle East crisis. Very special guest with us from Washington, Bridget Gabriel. Bridget, thank you for waiting through that discussion with General Lou McKenzie.
Sure.
You were telling us about what you went through in the bombardment of Katusha rockets as a child. You came to America. What led you to, you were established in the Middle East. You were a former anchor for the Middle East Television Network. What led you to America?
Well, I married a war correspondent, an American war correspondent, while working in Jerusalem, and we both came to America.
And you were in communications, and you were having a career, and then all of a sudden, what happened? You founded the American Congress for Truth. I want our listeners to know why.
I founded the American Congress for Truth after September 11th because I realized jihad had come to America. Well, after I was wounded in the war, and here is why this means a lot to me, I ended up living in a bomb shelter from the age of 10 to age 17, between 1975 until 1982, under the bombardments of the radical Islamists that surrounded us. And back then, we called them Muslims. We didn't have to use the politically correct word of radical Islam. They had different names and different groups, and they were shelling us and bombing us because simply we were the Christian enclave in South Lebanon. We were the Christians working with Israel and establishing peace and hoping to protect our democracy and reserve our freedom in Lebanon. As Israel was the only country that understood what the Christians were going through, as the Muslims went around massacring the Christians in my country and driving them out of their homes. For 7 years of my life, this is how I lived. It was only in 1982 when Israel invaded Lebanon to basically drive the Syrian cannons away from South Lebanon. Those cannons were shelling Israel under the cover of a Lebanese resistance using the Islamic radical proxies in Lebanon to shell the northern towns of Israel for over 1 year until Israel was fed up with it. And that's why Israel entered Lebanon in 1982. I see the same thing happening again with the same players. It was Iran financing the radical Islamists in Lebanon. It was Syria supporting them and protecting them back in 1981-82. Only after Khomeini came to power in 1979 that he actually gave them a name. He realized there is a radical element growing in Lebanon and eliminating the Christians and fighting Israel. He organized them and gave them a name, the Party of God, Hezbollah. And he organized them. Those same elements were fighting Israel, trying to create trouble in Lebanon. Israel went in and cleared everything away. The world did not pay attention. When the Hezbollah attacked the Marines in 1983, America tucked tail between its legs and left. Hezbollah at the time was a one-year-old organization. The world, as a civilized nations, as a group, were not paying attention to what was happening in the Middle East to the Christians and to Israel. Today, the same enemies that were fighting, the Christian Lebanese and the Israelis, are now the cancer spreading throughout the world. And finally, the world is realizing what radical Islam is all about.
What does America, what do the American people need to really understand? What you heard Lou McKenzie saying how difficult it is sometimes to make Canadians understand. I think Americans understand it better. How do we get this message across that this is a frontline fight to be free?
Sadly, the only thing that's going to get it across is a national disaster. It was 9-1-1 in the United States that woke the Americans up and made them realize we are under attack. Not all Americans. The media, you know, I call the media liberals by DNA. You know, it's like...
I'm stealing that line.
It's in the gene. They are idealists, and it's wonderful to have these wonderful ideals that we should live in peace, that we should all get along together, that we should understand each other. The problem is we live in the real world, and the reality is there's a group of people who hate us so much that they are bent on killing us. Sadly, in a way, it's a double-edged sword. In Canada, it was good that they were able to arrest the terrorists that they were planning to blow up major elements in Canada. The sad thing is that Canada's not going to wake up unless you go through a disaster like we went through in the United States.
And on that point, Bridget, I want to beg your indulgence again and ask if you have another 5-10 minutes, because right after the news, we're going to be talking with Richard Marceau, a communications specialist, on media bias against Israel in Canada. And I'm wondering if you could stand by, join us during that conversation.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Montreal, we'll be right back after the news. Montreal and everybody listening on the World Wide Web, we're back. We're discussing the bodyguard of lies in this Middle East crisis, the problems of comprehension, media bias. With us from Washington is Bridget Gabriel, founder of the American Congress for Truth. That's AmericanCongressForTruth.com, not .org. I want to apologize for that mistake earlier, and the author of the upcoming Because They Hate, A Survivor of Islamic Terror Warns America. And Bridget was talking to us about media and the kind of knee-jerk media, how did you put it, Bridget, DNA, that lends them to almost a knee-jerk reaction to any perceived underdog, whether that underdog is really an underdog or a terrorist. We're very happy and privileged to have with us to discuss this issue in the Canadian perspective, Richard Marceau, who's a communication consultant and a former Bloc Québécois MP. Richard, welcome, and I thank you for being so patient today.
Well, thanks for having me, Darrell.
Richard, I want to address a general and a particular issue in the Canadian media. The general issue is, as we discussed earlier, in Europe, 82% as of July 17th support or understanding for Israel's position. Canada, generally, 57%. But those numbers break down in the Léger poll to dropping to 36% in Quebec. Now, what I want to ask you is the following. The general question is, how can the Canadian media be reached to understand that this little nation of Israel is not a religious state, but a frontline democracy serving all our interests? And secondly, and as importantly, because we're all Québécois here, and we're going to do some of this in French, by the way, because Brigitte is... and if the CRTC doesn't like it, well, the CRTC's relevance is another question. In Quebec, what hurt me as a Canadian, as a Quebecer, as someone who's given 30 years of my life to public service here, as someone whose mother is buried in this ground, as someone who works with unions and social action organizations, when I hear talk show hosts use expressions like les Juifs instead of les Israéliens, but never les Musulmans, when I hear talk show hosts go crazy, literally, I heard one talk show host on a noontime show go crazy when Jean-Pierre Blackburn had the audacity to call Israel an allié du Canada. What is the particular problem in Quebec, and what is the general problem in Canada? And I want you to address it through one more prism. In 1960, the first book on La lutte pour l'indépendance de Québec was written by Marcel Chaput, who was called Le Guide des Patriotes. And to donate an exemple, primordial, for an independent Quebec, the State of Israel, its welfare system, its citizen army, what has happened since then?
Oh, there are so many questions in that little segue, Beryl. I think the first, to answer your first question, I think what needs to be underlined and pointed to time and time again is the common values between Israel and Quebec and Canada. People don't realize that Israel, as you put out before, is not
a theocracy.
It is a vibrant democracy with many similarities actually with Quebec. 80% there's a national majority of 80% Jews in Israel, francophones here in Quebec. There are minority rights. There are Arabs sitting on the Israeli Supreme Court. If you don't like what the state is doing, you can sue the state in court. There's freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and those...
They share one more important thing, just on my agenda, Richard, pour un instant. Israel and Quebec, together with Italy, Sweden, and Denmark, are the only political jurisdictions, and I'll use that word carefully, political jurisdictions, in the world, with over 40% of its population tied to union movements.
Well, there you go. So there are so many things that are not known about Israel, and I think the main task ahead for Friends of Israel in Quebec, as well as in Canada, is to focus on the common values, the shared values that exist between Quebec/Canada and Israel, and that is something.
I'd like to call it Friends of Freedom more than Friends of Israel.
Well, you specifically asked for about
right,
Israel.
Right,
so,
right.
So that was the answer to that specific question. As for Jews and Israelis, it's not necessarily out of spite. Let me give you an example. My wife is a Toronto-born Jewish woman, and so many people around me and says, "Okay, so listen, is she Israeli? She's Jewish. What's the difference?" So there's a lot of people who don't realize or don't understand the difference between an Israeli and a Jew. And that's not necessarily out of spite. So I think that should be put out and said that quite clearly. The third thing about the media in general is I remember I'm a big TV watcher. I love to watch the news. On September 11th and in its aftermath, there was a huge difference in media coverage between American media and Quebec media. At the time, I found that the American media was focused on what was going on and the tragedies of the attacks, and very well understandable too. Whereas in Quebec at the time, there was way more perspective given, way more analysis of the situation, way more analysts on television explaining who is who and what is going on. Whereas this time around, it's exactly the opposite. I find American media to give a lot of perspective and background and context, and I don't see that in Quebec media. Understandably, we understand that there's a lot of Lebanese Canadians living in Montreal, and it's tragic what happened to them, and they're coming here, and there's a human face to the story that people grab to, and it makes for spectacular TV, and it's important news too. But there's a lack of perspective, there's a lot of explanation, and to me the summum was, and I was watching one of the TV shows in the morning in French, and at one point the interviewer said, "Well, I don't remember who started it, but it's not really important anyways because it's a big mess." Well, I'm sorry, it is important to say who started it, that Hezbollah crossed an internationally recognized border to kidnap Israeli citizens and kill 8 of them. To me, that is fundamental to understanding what's going on, and that's missing, I believe, in the media coverage in French.
Richard, please stay with us. I've got to pay some bills. We're back speaking with communications consultant Richard Marceau and Brigitte Gabriel of the American Congress for Truth from Washington on media views in Israel. Richard, I know you have a family day today, and I really appreciate your time. I want to ask you one more question because you brought up a very important point. How can we advocate for perspective that puts everybody, Canadians and Quebecers, on the same page that this is a fight with a sister for a support for a sister democracy and a fight for freedom? And why is there certain differences? For example, at the English electronic media, big difference between CTV and CBC. On the French side, TVI, LCN, very balanced. RDI, French CBC, almost impossible. What what makes up those differences, and how can we get the message across that this is all our fights?
Well, the message across is to put our message across is a never-ending process. We have to go back to basics that people forget. Let's not forget that most people's attention span is very very limited, and it's hard for them to get all the nuances. So we have to go back to the beginning, to the basics all the time, and repeat them. And one of the problems that we have, for example, with television.
Don't you ever get tired of having to explain that a bomb is a nuance?
I'm tired of saying that and repeating that Israel is a democracy and it's a very small state. And people don't realize, for example, when they watch the news, they'll put, let's say, a news story is about Israel, and the map of Israel will take the entire screen. And then the following story is about China, and the map of China will take the entire screen. And people don't realize that at Netanya, the country is only 9 miles wide.
And the whole length of the country is Montreal to Quebec City.
That's just after. Yeah. And those are the things that the contextualization, the explaining, going back to basics, that we have to go back time and time again. And again, saying, and I think for Israel, for Friends of Israel and Friends of Freedom in general, but more specifically for Friends of Israel, is to sometimes go away from the conflict and focus on the things that are in common. I go back to that, and one of the good examples that you pointed out is the number of people who are unionized.
Yes.
There was a great article signed in the Globe and Mail by the president of the Istahut, the Israeli...
labor union.
Yeah, and I wish that article was published in the French media, because this is something that I think would resonate with a lot of Quebecers, how the labor movement can help building bridges between Palestinians and Israelis and that type of thing. We have so much in common between Quebec and Israel, including, I was told when I went to Israel the first time around, that the Star of David, according to some historians, is a fleur de lis stylized over the years. So I found that quite interesting.
De souligner notre communalité universalité et pas de souligner notre particularité parochiale.
Yep.
And that's the message.
Yep.
Richard Marceau, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.
Bridget.
Yes.
Bridget Gabriel, you are a media bombshell in the sense that nobody gets the message across better than you.
Yes.
Now, you heard Richard Marceau. You understand Canada a little bit, the two solitudes. How is there any way to bring the American, as Marshall McLuhan said, the medium is the message, the American medium style into Canada? Or does it require a completely different affect?
Well, I would like to comment on what Richard said. And this is a perfect question you asked, and that is a part of the problem. Talking about all this nonsense of shared values, let me set the record straight so you can educate Canadians about how we do not have any shared values between the Israelis and the Arabs. The Arabs killed their children.
No. Richard was talking about shared values between the Israelis and Quebecers and Canadians.
That's right. But we need to also point out how the Arabs do not have any shared values with Western civilization. And this is something that the Western media is completely ignoring. We are dealing
with... Well, allow me again. I don't want to irritate you, but I'm going to use the word, let us say, the radical Islamic Arabs, because there are many Muslims, particularly from Lebanon, who are quite secular and have left and don't want anything to do with this.
Exactly. But I'm not talking about the radicals. I'm going to talk about regular Muslims who killed their daughters in the name of honor, and that is now practiced in Canada. Have we forgotten that? Have we forgotten about people?
And sadly, sadly, we've heard cases like that in Pakistan recently and in Nigeria.
Absolutely. And this is one thing that all Muslims have in common, no matter what country they live in, be it in Britain, be it in Canada, or be it in Afghanistan. Also, marrying multiple wives and abusing their wives and beating them. This is a commandment in Islam. This is something that the West and Canada do not want to talk about. This is a major difference between the Muslims in the Arabic world or in the Western world and Western civilization. Also marrying girls at a young age, at the age of 12, if Muslim father can marry his daughter. matter. How can anybody in any Western civilization accept that? How can any Canadian stand up and talk about at least the shared values between, I know a lot of Arabs in Canada talk about, well, we're all people, let's all focus about what we have in common. Canadians, when they support the Muslims in the Middle East and everything that the Arabs are standing up for, do not realize what they are supporting. And I think it is important to come out with the truth and let the Canadian know what type of people they're supporting and who they are fighting for. And I hear a lot of the people in the media talk about the poor civilians who are suffering because of the Israeli bombing, the poor Lebanese civilians. Let's set the record straight. Those civilians that have died in Lebanon since the beginning of the fighting between Israel and Lebanon are mostly Hezbollah members and their families. Hezbollah is not an army that operates in an army base. Hezbollah is a militia, a terrorist organization that operates out of their homes. They live with their families. Let's remember when America bombed al-Zarqawi in Iraq. We heard about the woman that died in the house who was 16 years old and the child who was 18 years old. That's al-Zarqawi's wife and child. This is when Israel is bombing Hezbollah elements in South Lebanon and in Beirut and in all over Lebanon. Most, 99% of these civilians you are hearing about are Hezbollah terrorists and their families. Israel went through extreme pain to avoid killing civilians. The reason why Israel is still being shelled in northern Israel is because the shelling is coming out of the Christian towns, my hometown, shelling Marja Yun and Klaya, which is shelling Kiryat Shemona and the northern Galilee, and Ramesh, which is shelling Nahariya and the other areas and Haifa. It is those Christian towns that Hezbollah is using as a human shield where they're parking their rockets. And this is why Israel have tried to avoid up to this point, taking out those cannons so not to inflict real damage on civilians. And this is the subject that the media is not bringing out.
Bridget Gabriel, as I said at the beginning of our interview, a rare, authentic, and eloquent voice. We thank you for being with us. I want to read two sentences from her vision statement. AmericanCongressForTruth.com is the website. Being concerned Americans from all backgrounds, both secular and religious, liberals and conservatives, we must work on the most important issue of the day, security. For if we lose our life because of fanatic terrorist attacks, no other issue matters. We won't be here to do anything about it. Bridget Gabriel, thank you for doing something about it. And Montreal, please look for her book, Amazon.com, Because They Hate, A Survivor of Islamic Terror Warns America. Bridget, we'll speak to you next time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Montreal will be right back with Andrew McCarthy from New York. Israel's war against Hezbollah is a watershed in the war on terror, as long as we understand that it's not just Israel's war, and it's not just against Hezbollah. Hezbollah is Iran. Those challenging words are written by our next guest, remarkable man named Andrew C. McCarthy. Andrew McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, worked with Rudy Giuliani, is a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. And Andrew, thank you. I know the show's been running late on schedule. Thank you for hanging on.
Farrell, good to talk to you.
What do we need to know about the connections between Iran and Hezbollah, and how long have they been going back, and why is Syria now involved?
Well, I think Hezbollah is really a creation of Iran. It goes back almost a quarter of a century at this point, and obviously its most signature events, I guess, if you will, are the murders not only of Israelis, and Hezbollah certainly exists in small measure for that purpose, but also attacks against United States and French military in the early 1980s.
We tend to forget, and I was astounded by this, when I appeared on a panel on CNN with the other week, their researchers had forgotten, somebody made a statement that Hezbollah has never done anything against the states, except as you point out in your article, course correction, and I encourage everyone to go on National Review online to see Andrew's articles. In 1998, Hezbollah was indicted under the Clinton administration. They were involved in 1993 in the attempt on World Trade Center. What is it in media that lets these things slip through their fingers or in our national consciousness?
You know, I think the 1970s were really a watershed for the media, and this may be an oversimplification, but before then, the media was essentially about reporting to us the facts on the grounds of places that we couldn't be at all times in places on our own. since then, I think there's a media narrative, and the facts, whatever they are squeezed and contorted in order to fit into the narrative that they want to play. I mean, anybody who says that Hezbollah hasn't attacked the United States hasn't been paying attention for a quarter of a century. And Hezbollah started out attacking the United States. They have bombed American military installations. They have killed American government officials. They have bombed American embassies long before there was an Al-Qaeda bombing East
Africa. Let's get into some of your specifics that you bring up. They were involved in the attacks on the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1988. They were attacked. They were involved in the USS Cole bombing. This is way before 9/11.
Well, those are Al-Qaeda operations, but I don't think you can separate out Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah because...
You used a very elegant phrase in your piece on course corrections in your article where you say Bin Laden drank deep the lessons of Hezbollah.
Well, that's absolutely so, and not only Bin Laden, but a guy I prosecuted in New York a number of years ago, the blind sheikh, involved in the...
Omar Abdel Rahman.
Yes, involved in the first attack on the World Trade Center and a later plot on New York City landmarks, but he again and again told the people who were his followers that if we had another four or five operations like was done on the U.S. Marines in Lebanon, that they could drive the United States entirely out of the Middle East.
Andrew McCarthy, please stay with us. We just got a break for news. We'll be right back with you.
Yep.
Or email Beryl, love me or hate me, at info@iapm.ca. Our guest is Andrew McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, has written a remarkable article called Israel's War with Hezbollah is Our War with Iran. And Andrew, thanks for being so patient. You go through a whole list of attacks and bombings where there was no response from the states. And you seem to imply that we've missed opportunity after opportunity after opportunity as North Americans, as Western democratic powers, to nip this thing in the bud in the 90s.
I think that's fair. I mean, our response to terrorism, at least in the United States in the 1990s, was to file indictments. And if you want to talk about the efficacy of indictments, consider the fact that the United States has had Osama bin Laden himself under indictment since June 1998.
That was what was in vogue at the time. That was about what the Clinton administration did.
Right, but that was before the embassy bombings, before the Cole bombing, and, of course, before 9/11.
Right.
And all we did when we had additional terrorist acts was add counts to indictments, except with the exception of the Cole, where we did nothing at all. You can either react with weakness or strength, and each has a consequence. And if you react to this sort of thing with weakness, then what you get is more of it. And I think that's what we're seeing.
You wrote, Bin Laden and his ilk drew from the well of Lebanon and from Afghanistan, where the mighty Soviets had abandoned the battlefield after a decade of frustration. These were shining examples, they assured their followers, that the so-called superpowers were paper tigers, that they were no match for the jihadist vision of Islam. If terrorists were committed enough and ruthless enough, they could win. Hezbollah has never stopped believing that. Iran has never stopped believing that as well.
Yeah, well, I think we're seeing it. You know, they seem to be more and more daring, but what it is, I think, is that they're more and more confident. What people, I think, need to understand is that, we say all the time that this is an ideological war, but I don't think that we let that penetrate. This is an ideological war. These people hate us. They think we're weak. And every time we do something that confirms them in that, they become more audacious in their behavior. And it's not irrational audaciousness. They've done outrageous things, and the comeuppance for it has really been lacking. And when you create that kind of a pattern, then you're going to get more of the same, and that's what we've gotten.
You've had a remarkable career. You know the government inside out, federal prosecutor, intellectual writer, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. What can America now do as a policy move against Iran to staunch it, short of war?
Well, I don't know that, I mean, the bottom line is we may get to war, and I think we need to be ready for that because they perceive weakness, and if we signal to them that that's a line that we won't cross, then they have the upper hand no matter what happens. So I think we need to make it clear to them that we're serious to the point of being willing to go to war if we have to do that in order to get them to stand down from the things we need to get them to stand down on. And that very much includes their nuclear program. So I do think that we have to stop pretending to be an honest broker. We have to stop pretending that it's somehow rational that an honest broker is somebody who is a neutral between a loyal ally like Israel and a barbaric, savage terrorist organization like Hezbollah. I think we really do. I know that it's important to try to cultivate where we can in the Muslim world, but it's more important and it will convey more influentially in that part of the world that they understand that you know, we have American interests and we intend to serve them.
Andrew McCarthy, thank you for your time. I know it's Sunday and you've been patient on the line. Listeners, please go see Andrew McCarthy's writings on nationalreview.com and at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Andy, good luck.
My pleasure.
We'll be
Thank
speaking
you very
again.
Much.
Take care.
Bye.
We have Carol on the line.
Hi, Beryl.
Carol, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. It was worth waiting, eh, to have a privilege to voice out ideas and opinions.
I apologize. I've been apologizing to everybody because there have been so many calls and so many guests and so much to say on this.
You no need to apologize. This is how it works on radio. The ones who don't have patience enough, well, they know what they have to do.
How are you
the
doing today?
Like me, I'm doing great. Nevertheless, what you said in your introduction, you took about the three-quarter of what I wanted to say, and what Mrs. Bridget said about some civilian being on the side of Hezbollah, it's also what I wanted to say, so that saves half of the time for me to speak.
You can have all the time you want.
And also, I want to denounce those morons downtown that they showed on the TV. One was carrying Israel flag with the dirty swastika on it. Now, I don't understand. Here, if you call somebody Nazi for no reason, you may be prosecuted. But they let it go like nothing happened. Now, these people would have deserved to be arrested, the ones who was wearing this.
Well, I don't know. You know my positions on politics, but I think when we're fighting the war against terror, we have to remember what Churchill said, never to mirror what we seek to destroy.
Yeah.
So, you know, these hate laws are very touchy because, obviously, look, if somebody's going to out there and saying, kill the Jews, you know, obviously that's an open call, kill the Jews, right? So that is a crime. Because you're inciting violence. But, you know, even as a Jew, if somebody's making a speech and they're saying, I question whether the Holocaust happened, that, he's crazy. Part of freedom is the right to be stupid. So let him be stupid. I wouldn't prosecute a guy like that.
Well, maybe you got a point there. But anyways, me and you, we don't reason exactly the same way. I take more an aggressive stand.
I appreciate that, and I'm not saying what happened was not offensive. I'm just saying it shouldn't be under the rubric of a prosecution. We have to be on the front lines in a democracy of dialogue and confrontational dialogue at times.
And also, you were saying here.
Carol, can you hang on one quick break? Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Montreal, we'll be right back. Montreal, we're back, and we're talking to Carol on the Mideast crisis. Carol. Oh.
Yeah, thanks again. And I also want to point out, now, I may not be politically correct right now what I'm going to say, but this is really what I feel. When it was the first attack of the 9/11, way before things degenerated here in our streets, I even heard some, because we're talking about two oppressed people here, people from Israel, and before it was called Israel, the Jewish religious people, and the blacks. Now, there used to be some French station that even some black-speaking French Africans, I don't know if it was Senegal or another country, they were almost glad that it happened to the States. Like, a lot of them are anti-Jewish and anti-American. We have to beware for those people, too. They should know of all people, when they were oppressed, what it's like to be oppressed. And now what a switch, you see. There's more and more, there's not only Arabic people here and French Canadian who are against the liberties and who think that Israel is not an ally, that's what they're saying. There's more and more blacks who take into the part into this nonsense. And this is what I want to warn the people, to be very watchful for everybody here, not only for the Arabs or the Muslims.
Carol, thanks very much for your call.
I thank you.
Our next guest, Montreal, is arguably one of the world's most eminent analyst of international security affairs. Edward Luttwak is a senior fellow at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. His works have appeared both in scholarly journals, many of his own books, journals such as Foreign Affairs and Commentary. We're pleased and proud to have him with us. Edward Luttwak, thank you for being so patient and waiting today.
Very good.
Mr. Luttwak, you've written, Iran's leaders decided to trigger a Middle East crisis of their own by organizing recent attacks against Israel. Their aim is to discourage the U.S. and the Europeans from starting another crisis vis-a-vis Iran. Iran's moves were prepared in a series of meetings with its local allies, both Hamas of Palestine and Hezbollah of Lebanon. We've heard from Andrew McCarthy and Bridget Gabriel and other guests that Iran is the linchpin. What can be done short of war?
Well, the Iranians are very nervous. They have been frantically denying it. They obviously cannot cancel the facts, but they say we have nothing to do with it. Hezbollah is independent. They minimize the aid given to them and so on, which means that they are frightened.
Do they deny the $100 million of aid that CNN...
They deny everything. They said that there was some help, but that they have nothing to do with it. They don't control Hezbollah and so on. They have this, instead of proudly claiming the allegiance of Hezbollah, which Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, keeps repeating, they deny it, and which shows that they're afraid. They're afraid, first of all, obviously, of Israeli action, because the Israelis have established a considerable deterrent capability by acting as they've done, showing that they're not afraid of anyone or anything, and that they will strike back. The Iranians are also aware of the fact that in spite of all the pictures showing bombing of Lebanon, they know that all of this bombing has occupied maybe one-tenth of the Israeli Air Force, no more than that. So they're nervous, and...
Should we be nervous because they're nervous, or is there going
to
be...
No, the question is that... What needs to be done about Iran, you know, has been solemnly asserted by Russia and China, France, Britain, and the United States in the United Nations Security Council, where Iran was formally ordered to stop enriching uranium. The Iranians keep saying that it is their right under the Non-Proliferation Treaty to enrich uranium, and the answer of the whole world, because India and countries like Brazil and Argentina and India voted at the International Atomic Energy Authority to condemn Iran. All countries actually voted, except for Venezuela and Syria, against Iran. The unanimous voice of the world is that they are not allowed to enrich uranium, no matter what they might claim their rights to be. In other words...
So we understand that Iran benefited from this by getting them off the table of the Jihad agenda. When we come back after this break, I want to ask you about what Syria has to gain from this. Montreal will be right back. Montreal, we're back examining the Middle East crisis, and with us we're proud to have Edward Luttwak, senior fellow at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. Professor Luttwak, we understand what Iran got to gain. They got off the G8 agenda. Their nuclear program was not discussed there as a priority. What does Syria have to gain by being involved with all this?
Well, the Syrians can now show to the world what is the result of pushing them out of Lebanon. So long as they controlled Lebanon, the Israelis and the whole world had an address. If there was misbehavior by groups within Lebanon that the Lebanese state did not control. When Hezbollah started throwing rockets, the Israelis would talk with Damascus and simply tell the Syrians that if they didn't stop, they would hit the Syrians. The Syrians, what the Syrians have to gain from this crisis is that the world will invite them back into Lebanon. That's inevitable.
Just to be a player. Just to be a
fail to create their own functioning state.
Just to be a player after the Hariri embarrassment.
Hariri assassination. They've been pushed out. They'll be invited back in because it will serve everybody's interest to have somebody responsible for the territory of Lebanon instead of being abandoned. And the Syrians could get even more than that if they're willing to abandon their alliance with Iran. Because the oil-rich countries, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, would really reward the Syrian government if it stops this unnatural alliance, as they see it, with the Shiite of Iran against the Sunni world.
Edward Litvak from Washington, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Dave on the line.
Good afternoon.
Dave, how are you?
I think at this point we have to look at, this is a whole different type of warfare. You know, right now we see civilians being living among terrorists. And it's very, very...
Or tragic. Terrorists living among civilians, you mean?
Exactly. And this is extremely different from what it was like 40 years ago. And this is why I think the world has to be on guard. It's not a question anymore of, you know, everybody has to be watching out in their own neighborhoods, even, I believe. And in the subway system in Montreal, even, something as simple as that. It's really scary that we've come to this point. And I just feel that it, with you know, I just don't know what else to say except that we've all got to be benevolent. We've all got to be alert. Immigration has to be very careful who they let in here. There's going to have to be a lot more surveillance on the part of Canadian authorities in the near future to just keep a watch over things.
There was a great judge in Ireland in the 19th century named John Philpot Curran who said the price of liberty and freedom is eternal vigilance.
I think,
and that is where we have to be as a free people.
The most important thing, though, is that I think we haven't been touched in the past 40 years. So we've sort of become so comfortable that we haven't woken up. We've got to wake up at some point to realize the truth that we've got to be on our guard like the rest of the world.
Dave, very eloquently said, and I thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Montreal, that's it for this week. I want to thank Chris Smith. I want to thank Val Prudnikoff. And I want to leave you all with a thought. The concessions offered by the West to the world's terror machines, the folks who brought you everything from the World Trade Center, the coal bombing, the embassy bombings, hasn't helped. Because it's not just about terror. It's not just about Hezbollah. It's not just about aiding Iraqi insurgents. It's about taking over the free world and putting it under the thumb of a theocratic tyranny. The enemy, as you've heard, at the bottom line is Iran. Hezbollah, clients. Syria, clients. And as Andrew McCarthy said and wrote at the end of his paper, this is all our war. The war of all free men, and Israel today is doing the heavy lifting. It's time to stand with our real partners. See you next week.